Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. This is Epilepsy Awareness Month, the month of November, and we are hosting a great webinar today in honor of this exciting month. So my name is Stephanie Gandomi. I'm a genetic counselor here at Ambry. Ambry Genetics is very actively involved in supporting epilepsy awareness, and we have done a number of activities throughout 2014. Many of our papers, presentations, and activities are listed on our website and can be viewed at your convenience. Today, we have wonderful speakers. The first speaker is Tom Stanton. He is here with us today from Chicago and is the executive director of the Danny Did Foundation. His own nephew, Danny, was lost shortly before his fifth birthday to SUDEP, and that was his inspiration for driving advocacy through this amazing organization. Our second speaker is Glenna Steele, who's here with us today, and she is the current president of the GLUT1 Deficiency Foundation and is also a mother of a daughter with GLUT1 deficiency. Her daughter was diagnosed in 2008, and throughout the years, Glenna has provided numerous support and advocacy for families with epilepsy and GLUT1 deficiency around the world. As usual, we have a question and answer session at the end, so please feel free to enter any of your questions or comments into the Q&A box on the lower right-hand side of your screen, and we'll present these questions to our speakers at the end. We also ask if you have a moment to please complete the short survey at the end of this presentation that will automatically pop up once you log off WebEx. Thank you so much for being with us here today, and I will turn the floor over to Tom to begin his presentation about the Danny Did Foundation.
Thanks a lot, Stephanie, and thanks to everybody for joining on to this webinar. To take some time to learn about epilepsy and seizures during Epilepsy Awareness Month. As Stephanie mentioned, Danny Did is a Chicago-based nonprofit, and we help families across the United States that face epilepsy, and we provide support to both children and adults. So Danny's story is really the story that guides our foundation. Danny was my nephew, and the foundation was created in honor of his life. Danny had three siblings and had a huge impact during his short life and is very much missed in his community and by his family. Danny died on December 12, 2009, just before his fifth birthday. And the name of the Danny Did Foundation stems from the last line of his obituary, which was written by his dad, and it read, "Please go and enjoy your life, Danny Did." Danny's cause of death was something called sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, or SUDEP as an acronym. And the first time that Danny's parents had heard that term was from Danny's coroner. So a little bit about epilepsy, and this might be covering some basics that people already know, but the simple definition of epilepsy is the occurrence of two or more unprovoked seizures. An example of a provoked seizure would be one that occurs due to a fever or during withdrawal from drugs or alcohol. Epilepsy does not discriminate demographically. It can develop at any age, and it's sometimes referred to as a seizure disorder, which sometimes it's a confusing point for families who are new to this disease. I think it's worth noting that epilepsy is much more common than a lot of people realize. According to the NIH, 1 in 26 people will develop epilepsy over their lifetime, and epilepsy impacts 65 million people around the world. The treatment costs associated with epilepsy are enormous. So Danny's foundation was founded in 2010 by his parents with the mission to prevent deaths caused by seizures. And of course, the ultimate solution to achieve this mission is to find a cure for seizures. Our foundation is kind of a small family-led effort, and so we stick to two main areas of focus. The first one is to spread awareness of epilepsy generally. Epilepsy has traditionally taken a back seat to other causes when it comes to awareness, and that is due mainly to the stigma that surrounds seizures. We also work to advance awareness of SUDEP, which is the leading cause of death in epilepsy. And a key piece to the SUDEP awareness effort is to encourage doctors to talk with families facing epilepsy about the risk of SUDEP. So a little bit about SUDEP. Many families don't know that seizures can sometimes be fatal. And beyond that, some families are even told that seizures cannot be fatal. And that's bad information to receive. And so we try to encourage doctors to have upfront conversations with families about the range of possibilities, just like you might get a range of possibilities when you have a diagnosis of cancer or some other type of disease. So when it comes to the possibility of death and epilepsy, SUDEP is one cause. Others are something called status epilepticus, which is essentially a seizure that does not end without intervention. And then, of course, a seizure can lead to accidents such as drowning, car accidents, and other types of accidents, even suicide, as other ways that seizures can be fatal. More people die annually as a result of seizures than from fires and SIDS combined, which is kind of a startling statistic for some people to hear. And even though SUDEP is the leading cause of death in epilepsy, it's rarely discussed with patients. And then in this last bullet, we outline that SUDEP is second only to stroke among neurological disorders in years of potential life lost, which you might guess is an estimate of the average years a person would have lived if he or she had not died prematurely. This is a print ad that we ran in a magazine called Neurology Today. The purpose was to encourage neurologists to empower their patients by talking about SUDEP. And so this is one of the tactics that we take, is to advertise, both in a targeted community among neurologists and then in mainstream society to get the word out about epilepsy. So the second area of focus for Danny's Foundation is to spread awareness and educate families about technologies and devices that can enable early intervention when seizures occur. So we try to be very upfront that devices aren't a silver bullet solution to prevent seizures. In fact, currently the devices at market do not prevent seizures. They simply are alerting functions, but they can help to reduce the risk that accompany epilepsy. And that's a big advantage for the person who is seizing. And many parents are unaware that these device options exist. And that was the case for Danny's parents as well. So most devices do not have FDA approval, and thus they are not covered by insurance, which presents a funding challenge for a lot of adults with epilepsy or parents of children with epilepsy. And so that's where our foundation tries to bridge the gap to access. And we've funded devices for families across 47 states and 6 countries to date. And the feedback that we get around these devices is moving and often described as life-saving. So why should a parent or a person with epilepsy consider a device? It's an added layer of monitoring support. So we always tell parents or roommates or spouses that the device isn't going to replace your vigilance or your instincts, but it can be kind of a safety net for your vigilance. Devices can complement medicinal, surgical, and dietary treatments. They're not, at least yet, meant to replace them, so they're complementary to a treatment plan. And I think the biggest factor for considering a device is because it can enable early intervention. And that is going to lead to only good things when it comes to seizure activity. To get somebody present into the room is a huge advantage for that person who's seizing. If someone else is there, they can take steps to make sure that person is safe, as opposed to the scenario that Danny faced where, you know, his family members came in after the fact and it was too late. So it's really important to be upfront with families and adults facing epilepsy about, you know, what monitoring devices can and can't do. Most devices that are at market right now make no claim to prevent seizures from occurring or that they can stop a seizure that is underway. Most devices at market right now really only measure for movement, so they're movement monitors. And, of course, no device is clinically proven to prevent SUDEP, just as there's no medicine, surgery, or diet that can prevent SUDEP today either. So a common question that we get from families is which device is the best one? And that's not a question that we're particularly looking to answer. Our aim is not to endorse any one device, but instead we try to present the range of options to a caregiver, an adult with epilepsy, or a parent, and let them decide which one is best for their situation. And ideally, this decision-making process happens in consultation with their doctor. You know, one guiding light for which device to choose is definitely the area of greatest concern. So, for example, daytime seizures versus nighttime seizures, and that can guide the decision-making process. And then we also encourage families to be practical. So if there's a wearable device, you know, is the child going to want to keep that on? If there is a device that needs an accessory, such as a smartphone, is the child old enough to you know, manage and keep a smartphone close to them? So there's all sorts of considerations. We definitely encourage families, parents, adults with epilepsy to, you know, give questions to their doctors and have a conversation around what they're thinking of, just like they would if they were thinking about changing medications or considering if they were eligible for a certain type of surgery. We list some of those questions. We try to share this information with doctors so that they can feel like they're equipped to answer these questions to the best of their ability. Obviously, doctors have you know, busy schedules and a lot going on in terms of different treatment evolutions, not just with devices, but it's really important that they try to stay up to speed with what is out there so they can try to give their patients the best possible advice. In addition to talking with doctors about device options, we always encourage families to vet out the company that makes a device and really put questions to them about, you know, what is their target audience and some of the other functional capabilities of the device. And we always say that, you know, when you vet out a company and you give them a call or you send them an email, how they respond to you is really going to be the indicator of how your relationship is with them moving forward. So you really want to look for great customer service, companies that encourage questions, companies that are responsive. And so in doing this vetting process, you're really kind of getting a preview of what's to come. And that's really important when you're going to make this type of investment. So really common questions that we get from the families that we interact with are related to the cost of devices and whether or not they're covered by insurance. Most devices are not covered by insurance at this point. So as you might imagine, pricing and access to them financially is a big issue. So there's different ways that devices set up their pricing plan. Some of them have one-time costs. Some of them have reoccurring monthly costs. And so figuring those out and sorting out how they're different is important as you go through, as a family goes through this process. But ultimately, you know, there is a growing, albeit small, percentage of instances where a device will be covered by insurance. And really, to get that to become more common, it's going to take patients and doctors pushing more from insurance companies to demand coverage. And really what will help elevate that or expedite that is when some of these devices get FDA approval. So the next couple of slides talk about some devices at market, and I won't belabor these too long, but just wanted to give kind of a preview or a sampling of what's out there for families to consider. So one is called the MFIT Movement Monitor, and it's a Finnish company that is based in Austin, Texas for their U.S. office. This is a device that's been around for a few years and has considerable clinical tests behind it, which is obviously favorable when you're looking at your options. They're seeking FDA approval, and it's a device that goes between the box spring and the mattress of a bed, and it measures for repetitive, consistent movement that happens during sleep. So this is targeted at convulsive grand mal type seizures that happen during sleep, which is a very vulnerable time for people who have seizures. MFIT also makes a second device. This one is new, just came out a few months ago, called the MFIT QS. And this is a bit more comprehensive than the movement monitor in that it measures for heart rate, respiration, and in addition to movement. The major difference with this device is that it's currently not an alerting device. So it would have to be used in companion with the movement monitor if a family wanted to be alerted. But it is kind of the next wave of device type in terms of being more comprehensive for what it measures. So this is a newer device from MFIT. The next one we have listed is called the smartwatch, and that's from a company called Smart Monitor that's based in the Bay Area, Northern California. This is a worn device that measures for movement. It alerts caregivers via a text message and a phone call. So notable for this device, it requires a compatible smartphone that is on or near the user. So that's something that, you know, is accessible for some families and not for others. This particular device uses an activation fee and a subscription fee, and it has been tested in various settings, including Stanford. The next device is called the SAMI Alert, and this is also like the MFIT. It's designed to detect seizures that occur during sleep. This device centers around a camera that looks for movement and then sends a video feed back to an iOS device that is in the parent or caretaker's room. So this is attractive to a lot of parents due to its live video and video recording that can then be shared with a neurologist. This particular device, it sends an alert when it detects unusual activity, and that's an audible alert. This is one of the newer devices at market. The last one we'll overview is called the SleepSafe Anti-Suffocation Pillow, and it's designed to prevent suffocation during sleep seizures, developed by a gentleman in the United Kingdom. And it's a relatively modest in terms of its sophistication, but it's obviously designed to prevent a fatal accident and suffocation. So a lot of families use this in companion with other devices. So in terms of what's coming down the pipeline, as I mentioned, the next wave is going to be kind of more comprehensive in terms of being multi-module devices that measure for more than just movement. Most of these new wave devices will store data on the cloud that can be accessible to a patient's doctor. And, maybe a little further down the road are devices that conduct the intervention themselves instead of simply alerting to seizure activity. So there's a lot in the pipeline, and, the challenge for these companies, many of which are small, is just to get to market. They don't have some of the resources and bandwidth that pharma companies have, so it can be a challenge for them to make it to market. So what we say to families is, be broad in your research, start widely, and then hone in on the best option for your situation. Talk to your doctor, ask other parents for feedback, vet out the company, look for published data. There's a lot of due diligence that goes into making this type of investment, not just from a financial perspective, but in the fact that you're entrusting this device to help keep your loved one safe. So it's a very important decision. And beyond that, we encourage people to keep going, keep advocating, keep searching. You know, there are instances where some medical professionals or some people will discourage a family or a parent from going down this road and looking into these types of resources. But ultimately, they have to keep going and advocating for their loved one, because no one else is going to do it better than they will. So as far as genetics and epilepsy, and this is a topic or an area that is becoming more and more important to families who face seizures, and they're learning about the importance of genetic history, and they want to know, how can they be educated? What are their options? And one thing Dani did can do is to be a conduit for information. So utilize us and help. We can help share information about research, resources, options when it comes to genetics for patients and families. We can be that information portal to get them their options. So this last slide is really important to us, how to get involved. We want to collaborate with medical professionals across the U.S. and across the world. So we're open to that, and we want to, make as many new relationships as we can. You can help us in simple ways by sharing our materials with patients or referring them to our website, just letting them know that we exist and that we're here to offer certain resources. You can support SUDEP registries that count the number of epilepsy deaths that occur annually. We partner with one specific effort at NYU that's growing rapidly called the North American SUDEP Registry. And the more doctors that are aware of that effort, the better. And then lastly, we invite people to volunteer, to donate, and to look at other ways they can get involved with our cause on our website, which is danidid.org. And through our various social media channels as well. So that's the long and short of Dani Did, and thank you again for your time and for learning more about us.
Thank you, Tom. And we're gonna now pass the ball over to Glenna, and she will give us some information about the GLUT1 Deficiency Foundation.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be here today. I appreciate the opportunity to join the webinar. We appreciate Ambry Genetics for inviting us, and thanks to Stephanie and all who've joined us today, and thanks to Tom for kicking us off with a wonderful presentation. I know I learned a lot. The GLUT1 Deficiency Foundation was formed in 2011 to help patients with who are battling GLUT1 deficiency. GLUT1 deficiency is also known as glucose transporter type 1 deficiency syndrome, and it is a rarely diagnosed metabolic condition where glucose isn't transported properly across the blood-brain barrier, and this leaves the brain starving for the energy it needs to grow and function as it should. And this energy crisis causes an array of signs and symptoms, and these occur across a broad spectrum of severity, and not all patients experience all symptoms, but most experience a majority. And GLUT1 deficiency is also known as G1D, GLUT1, GLUT1DS, or DeVivo disease. GLUT1 deficiency is caused by a mutation on the first chromosome of the SLC2A1 gene. There are approximately 100 different mutation types associated with this gene found in different patients. There have been some efforts to try to make correlations between some of the genetic types, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But there is a wide range of mutations found, and there's been some success with correlations, but not a great deal. Most patients, their GLUT1 deficiency is caused by a de novo mutation. About 90% of patients currently identified although there are several cases of inherited GLUT1 deficiency. And with both patients, it's most commonly inherited through an autosomal dominant pattern. Although there are some rare cases where patients inherit the recessive gene from a parent that has not displayed any symptoms in the past, or very mild symptoms, or seemingly unrelated symptoms, but they are found usually once the child has been diagnosed. Who has GLUT1 deficiency? Currently, there are about 500 cases worldwide, although experts believe there are many more. It affects both genders and all ethnic groups equally. The average age of diagnosis is between 5 and 6 years old. So since it is a genetic condition, it's present at birth. But most patients spend a number of years in the intractable epilepsy domain. Some have a cerebral palsy diagnosis. So earlier detection, finding patients earlier to get treatment started earlier, is an important aspect to consider when thinking about GLUT1 deficiency and why more medical professionals need to be aware and looking for it sooner and more frequently. There have been several families discovered with multiple relatives, and these can be affected in different ways and to varying degrees, even when they share the same type of mutation. The presentation or the phenotype can be very different. They've also found recently that about 10% of early onset absence seizures, a distinct set of subset of the seizure population, about 10% of those cases are actually GLUT1 deficiency. And about 5% of patients with myoclonic astatic epilepsy or Duse syndrome or Dose syndrome, about 5% of those actually have GLUT1 deficiency. And it's been estimated that about 1% of the general epilepsy population may actually have GLUT1 deficiency. And we'll talk a little bit more in a minute about how not all patients have seizures. So even if we just look at the patients with seizures, if 1% of the general epilepsy population actually has GLUT1 deficiency, we're talking about numbers much, much larger than what the 500 or so currently diagnosed. We do have a patient registry now that's active, so we're hoping that's going to help give us a more thorough accounting of the number of patients and the locations of those patients, you know, along with all the other critical details and information and patient data that can help make correlations between patients and find commonalities and help lead researchers to better understanding and hopefully better treatments down the road. And that registry is www.g1dregistry.org, and that's an effort from Dr. Juan Pascual at UT Southwestern. So we do encourage all patients to participate. What are the symptoms? The more common symptoms may include seizures, movement disorders, speech and language disorders or delays, developmental delays, varying degrees, some episodes of confusion, loss of energy can be included in that too, and then headaches. And some less common symptoms can include alternating hemiplegia of childhood. More recently, they found hemolytic anemia, opsoclonus, which is a random kind of rolling eye movement, most apparent in very young children, and then microcephaly, which is decelerated head growth rates, not in all patients, but in some. And it's important to note that most patients appear normal at birth, and pregnancies are uneventful, and deliveries are uneventful and normal, and Apgar scores are typically normal for patients, too. The seizures in GLUT1 deficiency, 90% of patients have seizures, and these can be multiple types. About 90% of those patients with seizures, the seizures begin before age 2. I think the most common age range is 6 to 12 months, although some patients have presented much later, you know, 9, 10 years old, some even older than that. The seizures associated with GLUT1 deficiency, if they're detected early and the diagnosis is made early, lots of times those can be classified as focal, and over time those evolve to a more generalized EEG pattern. AEDs and anti-epileptic drugs, anticonvulsants, are usually not very beneficial or of a fleeting benefit. Good effects usually don't last long if there are good effects. And then sometimes the side effects can complicate the condition. It can interfere with glucose uptake. And so generally AEDs are of little use in the condition. Recent research does show that seizures generally improve to some degree as patients enter adulthood. The energy demands in the brain diminish over time. bulk of growth and development have taken place in childhood and early adolescence. So once the energy demands decrease, the symptoms generally settle. Doesn't go away, but symptoms do improve, although puberty can be a challenging bridge to cross in between. Probably the combination of hormones and changes in energy demand are somewhat at play, but it's an area that needs to be researched more thoroughly. And then also the seizure frequency does not seemingly correlate with the phenotypic severity, that just because a patient has more frequent seizures, more severe seizures, it does not mean that they have a more severe case of GLUT1 deficiency. The movement disorder component, the majority of patients experience some type of complex movement disorder. This can be dystonia, ataxia, chorea, spasticity, tremor, dyspraxia. The symptoms can be continuous or they can be intermittent or come and go. And they can be influenced by hunger, sickness, getting overheated, exerting themselves more than normal can all be triggers for some of the movement disorder events. And then there's been a newer subset identified of GLUT1 deficiency patients that the only symptom, the only hallmark is the PED, which is paroxysmal dyskinesias, and those are exercise-induced movement disorders. And then some of the recent research from a couple different groups has shown that while the seizures tend to improve over time, the movement disorders can worsen as patients enter adolescence and early adulthood. Developmental delays is another typical hallmark of the condition. Most patients experience some degree of cognitive delay, and it can range from mild to moderate learning disabilities to severe intellectual disability or delay. Most patients do require special assistance in school, enrolled in special ed programs with IEPs and 504 plans, and then on into adulthood, usually structured supports are required. Speech and language development can be affected. Both receptive and expressive are both impacted, but more severely the expressive language. And then dysarthria and disfluency can also be common in our patients. And then gross and fine motor development can be affected, you know, aside from the movement disorder, just the general overall motor development can be a sign as well. And GLUT1 deficiency is diagnosed, most importantly, through a lumbar puncture. And it should be done following a four-hour fast. And the blood glucose level should be checked at the same time the spinal fluid glucose is checked. And the blood glucose will always be in the normal range. And then there'll be low CSF glucose, usually below 60 milligrams per deciliter, although the majority fall below 40. There are some that have been discovered as high as the 60 range. And then a comparison is made between the CSF and blood glucose, and that ratio is usually less than 40%. And then CSF lactate is usually low, normal, or low. And there is also a genetic test available that tests this SLC2A1 gene, and it's been reported that it has an 85 to 90% accuracy rate, depending on how that test is performed. And even though there is the genetic test, the CSF lumbar puncture is still the recommended first step, and then the gene test secondly after the low glucose CSF results. And it's best to begin with a sequence analysis and then proceed to a duplication or deletion if the sequencing is inconclusive on the gene test. And some of the experts will diagnose case of GLUT1 deficiency with a negative gene test if the CSF results indicate GLUT1 deficiency and the symptoms are there. The diagnosis will be made with a negative gene test. And then there's a third option, and that's the red blood cell uptake assay. It's currently available in the research setting, but it's considered to be by many the gold standard for diagnosing GLUT1 deficiency, and it's a actual functional measure of glucose transport across the cell membrane. Some genetic considerations. SLC2A1 is the only identified gene involved. As I mentioned before, there were some efforts to correlate the types of mutations and the locations of the mutation with the phenotypic picture. and what they have discovered so far, that the missense mutations are generally found in the mild and moderate category. The nonsense mutations and insertions and exonic deletions are the moderate to severe. And then, as you'd probably expect, the complete deletions are in the severe range. And there are efforts underway to classify GLUT1 deficiency cases into about three to four. We've seen both categories depending on severity and type of mutation or absence of mutation. So that's something we expect to hear much more about in the coming years, and hopefully more correlations can be made. How is it treated? While there is no cure, we are fortunate in our patient community and in the rare disease world to have a treatment. The ketogenic diet is the standard of care. And for those of you not familiar with the ketogenic diet, it's very effective in many patients in the general epilepsy population to help control seizures, but it's particularly effective in our community with our patients. And ketogenic diet works by restricting carbs, and patients ingest high levels of fat, and this leads to the production of ketones, which the body uses as an alternative energy source in place of glucose in the absence of glucose. And in our patients, that is very effective against many symptoms in most all of our patients. And as I mentioned before, anticonvulsants are generally not effective, although some patients do benefit from a single medication in addition to the diet. It's rare to see patients in our community on two or three anticonvulsants, or, you know, a cocktail of drugs that many regular epilepsy patients require or seem to be straddled with. Many of our patients have been through that route, but once the diagnosis is made, you know, it's realized that they're generally ineffective and usually detrimental. There are several versions of the ketogenic diet. Historically, with our patients, the classical version has been preferred, especially in the younger children, in order to make sure that the ketone levels are high enough to produce the level of energy that the developing brain needs, particularly in early childhood. There is growing evidence that some of the alternative forms of the diet, the MCT version or the modified Atkins diet, are effective and seem to be especially so in older patients where palatability, some of the social implications with eating and around eating, and the diets can be a little less restrictive too, that all these lead to better compliance, which helps boost effectiveness of the treatment, especially in older patients. And there are some potential new therapies under investigation. There's been some recent research involving human patients indicating that triheptanolone, it's also known as C7, can be beneficial in treating GLUT1 deficiency. There was early work and ongoing work with the medical food version from Dr. Juan Pascual at UT Southwestern. And there are currently clinical trials for a pharmaceutical grade of the same product that's received an orphan drug designation from Ultragenyx Pharmaceuticals. And you can find information, more information about both at clinicaltrials.gov. Ketone esters are under investigation as a potential treatment, and studies are getting underway in the GLUT1 mouse model at the University of South Florida, and more research is needed in both areas to see what potential place they hold in treating patients. For more resources about GLUT1 deficiency, you can visit our website, www.g1dfoundation.org. There's an excellent gene review on GLUT1 deficiency and some information at the Genetics Home Reference, and a great FAQ at the Child Brain Foundation on GLUT1 deficiency. And we're fortunate to have some great ketogenic diet resources. The Charlie Foundation here in the United States and Matthew's Friends in the UK are a wealth of resources for patients on a ketogenic diet. And to talk a little bit briefly about our foundation, we're an all-volunteer nonprofit family organization, and we're dedicated to educating others about GLUT1 deficiency and increasing awareness of and advocacy for GLUT1 deficiency, and supporting and funding researchers as they work for better treatments and an ultimate cure. And our mission drives all of our foundation activities. Our history, I mentioned briefly getting started. Our initial meeting place was the Yahoo parent group, Yahoo online group. It was founded in June of 2004, and many families first got to know each other there at the Yahoo site, we started to talk about how nice it would be to get together in person. There were some family groups in Australia and Germany who'd done the same, and we wanted to have that experience. So we had a parent bravely volunteer to organize the first gathering, and we invited a couple of the doctors to come, and before we knew it, we had a full-fledged conference. We didn't really mean to, but we did, and once we were all together, we realized the power and the need for us to continue doing that. So our first meeting was in Chicago in July 2009. We met again the following year in Louisville, and that's when we started our talk about becoming more formally organized. And then we received our 501c3 status in 2011. Another milestone was seating our medical advisory board in 2013. And then we just had a leadership meeting this past summer. All of our original terms had expired, so we had created some new positions and expanded our board and have new officers and some new committees. So we're real excited about the direction going forward and the team we have in place. Our board of directors, and I'd show you this to first point out that we're all parents of GLUT1 deficiency patients, and then secondly to show you that we're scattered all across the United States. The director positions are new positions, and we're excited about the committees and the volunteers we have in each of those committees to move things forward. We have representatives from all across the United States. Our medical advisory board, we have Dr. DeVivo, GLUT1 deficiency is also known as DeVivo disease, from Columbia University, and then Chris Engelstad is research coordinator there, and she's also a genetics counselor. And we have Dr. Klepper from Germany. He helps with a lot of international efforts for GLUT1 deficiency. Dr. Juan Pascual, noted researcher and clinician at UT Southwestern, and then Dr. Eric Kossoff, who is a ketogenic diet expert at Johns Hopkins. I'm very thankful to have all of these people helping our patients. And this is just a picture. I'll go quickly through these. This was our very first conference and part of our key mission projects, the education piece, bringing families together in Indianapolis. And then our most recent one in Houston, and you can see our numbers of presenters and numbers of patients have steadily grown. And we opted at the end of 2013 to switch to an every other year meeting schedule. So the next one will be 2015 in Orlando, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. Another important piece of our education and awareness component is we have exhibit booths at some of the major national epilepsy and neurology, genetic, and pediatric conferences. We've done some local events, too, and we feel like this is a great way to raise awareness and encourage medical professionals who are in a position to find patients to keep GLUT1 deficiency in the back of their mind. There's a few more events we've attended, some local. And the gentleman pictured in the top left picture is Dr. Dong Wang. He created the mouse model for GLUT1 deficiency, so our community has a lot to be thankful to him for. And then the bottom right-hand corner is Dr. DeVivo. He likes to visit our booths when we have exhibits at conferences where he's presenting, and he's always a wealth of information for people who stop by. Another important part, and some of our recent important mission projects, part of our education and awareness and advocacy efforts, our very first project was to create our brochure. We scraped and scrounged and counted pennies and had a brochure printed and mailed it to all the pediatric neurologists we could find. And then we have followed up with that. We've got it translated into three different languages now and working on a couple more. Our website has evolved and will continue to evolve. In the middle of starting an upgrade on our website. We have the Yahoo group. We are not moderators there, but we're active presence on the Yahoo Health Forum. And there's a new Rare Connect online patient forum hosted by Eurydice that GLUT1 deficiency has a subset on that program. As I mentioned before, our professional conference exhibits, we've had some congressional meetings with some of our experts to talk about the challenges our patients and our community face and rare diseases in general. our family conferences we've already mentioned, and some collaborations with other international groups. We've helped sponsor some Grand Round teaching opportunities at a couple of different hospitals and quarterly newsletters, and we've developed a family recommended specialist list, and we've recently sponsored ketogenic diet symposium sessions on gluten deficiency. We're thankful to have that opportunity. And in supporting and funding researchers, since 2010, we've been able to contribute $233,000 to research, and that's been spent on C7 oil studies, both the mouse project in the beginning, then the human trials that followed, the natural history study that helped explain and predict what might happen over time with our patients, the patient registry that I mentioned before. We've helped support research personnel. We've helped support the ketone ester research that's getting ready to kick off. And then we've funded data gathering opportunities that are family conferences. And we've helped support work at the University of Texas Southwestern, at Columbia University, and the University of South Florida, and our first international project at the University of Salerno in Italy. And some of our fundraising efforts, we have an annual online campaign that kicks off on Valentine's Day and runs through Rare Disease Day, which is February the 28th each year, and it's called Love Someone with Gluten-1, and it's progressively grown. This will be our fourth year coming up, and last year we had 44 families participate from 8 different countries. There are lots of individual fundraising events to benefit the foundation. We have a lot of creative and energetic families who come up with some great ideas, and these fundraising events are also excellent opportunities at educating others and increasing awareness. There's often a lot of local press, and it's just a great way to get more people thinking about gluten deficiency. Individual donations and then corporate matches, and we participate in the Good Search, Good Shop, and Good Dining, and we've had some good success with those programs. And since the foundation is an all-volunteer group, all funds go directly to our mission. We appreciate everyone who has supported us in the past. And some of our upcoming projects, we have a lot of things on the horizon, but some of the highlights, we want to create a simple screening tool to use for use by practitioners and be able to share that at our educational booth. We'd like to launch a targeted diagnostic awareness campaign to get more people thinking about gluten deficiency and finding those patients and finding them earlier. And we'd like to facilitate a standard of care with professionals. We do have plans in place for our next family conference, which will be in July 2015 in Orlando. And in conjunction with that, we'll be hosting our first professional conference with poster sessions. And that's also in July. You can find more information about both of those at our website. And then we will be funding new research projects and sustaining some of the established ones already underway. And we just ask for your help in finding patients, spreading education and awareness, encouraging patients you know to use the registry, and you can visit our website to find more. A gluten deficiency diagnosis is life-changing, and we know there are many patients out there looking. We appreciate your help in finding them. And we invite you to join us at our next conference in Orlando, the family program on July 6th and 7th, and the professional program on July 8th. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And if anyone listening has any further questions for either Tom or Glenna, please feel free to contact them directly, or you can contact them through me, and I'll triage the question. Thank you so much for your time and for your advocacy and all of the work that you're doing. And we'll continue going through November and celebrating National Epilepsy Awareness Month. Have a great afternoon, everybody.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.